there are two kinds of handouts. One is a full script of my presentation. There are a few of them. And then there is a shortened version. But there is also an email there. Then you can write to me or to my secretary, Dorothy Shaw, and we will send you the whole copy of it. Because of the paper, it would be too many copies in full version. Well, the actual title of my paper is The Historical Eschatological Apocalyptic Fulfillment of the Prophecy Concerning Gog and Magog of Ezekiel 38 to 39. I will present it in a shortened form, and you can have, as I told you, some of you even now, the full version, and later on you can email me. Ezekiel, the prophet of the 6th century BC, after the tragic fall of Jerusalem in 587-586, present in his book a unique prophecy concerning Gog from the land of Magog, Ezekiel 38-39, which has stirred a bewildering amount of different interpretations. Ezekiel's pertinent prediction is certainly one of the most challenging texts of Scripture. Alexander, in his article, aptly writes, "The plethora of interpretations for this passage cautions the student concerning dogmatism in his conclusion." The New Scofield Bible, as well as Hollinson, for example, claim that Gog refers to Russia. In this paper, I do not discuss in depth the different popular or scholarly positions about the identity of Gog and their opinions on the fulfillment application of this prophecy, but explore primarily a biblical, historical, eschatological interpretation, namely how Ezekiel 38-39 is deciphered by later biblical writers, especially in the book of Revelation. This research paper does not attempt to be the last word in the discussion on Ezekiel's prophecy about Gog and Magog, but rather it primarily seeks to demonstrate the Christological, ecclesiological fulfillment. Therefore, it will be like in tune and continuation what Dr. Davidson presented. The structure, the literary structure of the book of Ezekiel is well developed and quite symmetrical, and helps to put in proper perspective the prophecy according Gog and his allies against Israel. It is placed in the second part of the book, after the fall of Jerusalem in chapter 33, and section on hope and restoration of Israel, chapter 34 to 39. And the last two chapters of that restoration motif deal with Gog and Magog prophecy. And it follows by the glorious vision about new temple and city. The statement, "This is what the sovereign Lord says," divides the two chapters of Ezekiel 38-39 into seven parts, because this phrase is employed seven times. One is first this presentation of Gog and his allies, then goes to Gog's pride and plot, then to Gog coming against Israel, then destruction of God's forces by God's judgment, then destruction and burial of Gog and his allies, then Gog's confederation at Yahweh's sacrificial feast, and Israel in the exile for their sin, and finally restoration of the fortune of Israel after captivity. Thus the prophecy ends with the event which is to happen first, the exodus from the Babylonian captivity, because this prophecy will be fulfilled only when Israel will return to their land and their yoke of captivity will end. Ezekiel 38:17 is the crucial text of the prophecy. This is what the Sovereign Lord says: "Are you, Gog, not the one I spoke of in former days by my servants, the prophets of Israel? At the time they prophesied for years that I would bring you against them." This statement affirmed that God, through his prophet, spoke about Gog in former days. It means that God spoke in the past about him in general sense, because nowhere else in the Old Testament is a direct prophecy about Gog mentioned. The name Gog appears only one other time, in 1 Chronicles 5:4, but it is in a genealogy and not in a prophecy. We need therefore to look for the main concepts of thoughts of Ezekiel's prophecy, which can be detected also in previous biblical prophecies, and thus the connections can be established among them. The most common concepts of many prophets and biblical writers are the concept of war and that of enemies from the north. Berkhover claimed that the northern powers, the north, frequently having been the origin of Israel's woes, it is an image that anticipates the eclipse of the ungodly powers of the world. And Otzen describes five principal motives in Ezekiel 38-39, the day of Yahweh, then war with the chaos and war with the nations, third, the foe from the north, fourth, attack of the nations upon Jerusalem, and fifth, the sacrificial meal. The principal and strongest motives are the concept of the sacrificial meal and the war, because they connect at the best with other biblical passages. From the larger biblical perspective, it is quite obvious that the battle here described is but the culmination of the age-long struggle between the powers of evil and the people of God. Concerning this, there is a frequent mention in earlier prophecies. The earliest information comes from the Garden of Eden in the curse pronounced upon the serpent. God predicted that there would be constant warfare between the seed of the woman, the church, and Satan. The ultimate triumph over evil was forecast in the clause, "It, the seed of the woman, shall bruise thy head," Genesis 3:15. Other references to the controversy and the eventual triumph of right are found in the Psalms and later prophetical books. It is apparent, therefore, that one cannot isolate Isaiah 38 and 39 from other Old Testament prophecies. One needs to discern the organic unity of all prophecies. Otzen directly, correctly summarizes, thus Ezekiel 38, 14 and 39 has the character of a mosaic of well-known Old Testament motifs. Well, what is the main thought in Ezekiel 38, 39? And you can now follow even with that abbreviated form of my presentation. My thought in that handout. It's on the second paragraph now. The leading message of the biblical prophecy about Gog and Magog is transparent. In the future, Gog will launch from the far north his antagonistic campaign with his allies against Israel after they have returned from Assyrian-Babylonian captivity and are living securely in the land. Then, the divine judgment will destroy Gog and his confederacy upon the mountains of Israel. Thus, Israel and all nations will know that Yahweh is God, and his holiness will be vindicated. Ezekiel uses three time expressions, Miyamim Rabim, after many days, and Be'acharit Hashanim, in the latter years, and Be'acharit Hayamim in the latter days. Well, I will not bother you with all these technical expressions here, but let me say that the expression in the latter days, used 13 times in the Hebrew portion of the Old Testament, is basically means in the future, in the following time, in days to come, in the latter days, and only context will decide if it is eschatological end or if it is only near or distant future. The three contemporary phrases I mentioned above do not refer directly or automatically then to the end time. In Ezekiel 38-39, there is no specific indicator which would necessitate putting this prophecy into the apocalyptic end-time scenario just prior to the second coming of Jesus Christ. The plausible position is that Ezekiel's prophecy refers to the events which should occur sometimes after the return from the Babylonian exile. There are five nations listed as Gog's allies in Ezekiel 38:5-6. Persia, Cush, Put, Gomer, and Beth Gomorna, besides Meshech and Tubal, already mentioned in verse 2. Thus there are altogether seven nations in this plot, in this confederation. Number 7 plays a significant role in Ezekiel, symbolizing completeness or totality and pointing to a universal conspiracy, a world plot against Israel. The number of enemies is described in figurative language. You and all your troops and the many nations with you will go up, advancing like a storm, like a cloud covering the land. Ezekiel 38:9. Even though many solutions to the enigma of Gog's figure have been offered, there is no consensus among scholars who Gog is. Different theories have been proposed for the names of Gog and Magog with diverse historical and symbolic or mythological interpretations. And in my paper I have a whole list of different proposals. I will not go through all these hypotheses and theories, because it would take plenty of time. But you can read it for yourself. There is a summary of it there in the footnotes, long footnotes. I do not support any historical fulfillment which falls prior to the Exodus from the Babylonian exile or during it, because Ezekiel predicts a future event from his perspective. I also reject political modern applications related to the second coming of Christ, which overlook the New Testament interpretation of this prophecy. And I also oppose the mythological explanation, because the literary genre of Ezekiel 38:39 presupposes its historical fulfillment. On the other hand, I stand for the symbolic historic interpretation rooted in the New Testament interpretation of this prophecy, where especially the book of Revelation provides material for the eschatological, apocalyptic understanding of Ezekiel's prophetic scenario. On the basis of known historical documents, one can safely conclude that there is no event in the history of Israel which would match with the Ezekiel's description of Gog's intervention against the antagonistic forces of their enemies. No such past happening is ever recorded, therefore no literal historical fulfillment. The closest but partial historical fulfillment of this prophecy in Old Testament times and the intertestamental period occurred during the Maccabean Wars in the 2nd century before Christ, when a few numbered Jews, the Maccabees, under the leadership of Judah Maccabee, revolted against the Seleucid king Antiochus Epiphanes IV and unexpectedly defeated an enormous and well-trained Hellenistic army. The Maccabees waged war against this oppressive Hellenistic ruler, who not only wanted to subjugate them, but also change their culture and even religion. The commemoration of their surprising victory gave birth to the Hanukkah festival. However, it needs to be stressed that it does not mean that this explanation provides the full historical fulfillment, because all details predicted in the prophecy were not literally fulfilled. As for example, Antiochus IV Epiphanes did not die in Israel, his army was not defeated in the manner asserted in Ezekiel, Israel did not live in the time together, altogether in security, etc. In this way, Gog, as a leader of the confederacy against Israel, can be only partially identified with this antagonistic figure. Nevertheless, when one has a partial historical fulfillment, one encounters a type. If there is no clear and full historical fulfillment of Old Testament prophecies, one must carefully study the if and how the New Testament interprets them, whether explicitly or implicitly. Jesus Christ's teaching must be taken as the key interpretative factor, and the New Testament-inspired writers as the best expositors of different Old Testament predictions. And our basic hermeneutical principle in studying them is that the New Testament removed the geographical and ethnic restrictions of Old Testament prophecies while maintaining the Middle East imagery. The principal thought of Ezekiel 38 and 39 can be summarized into 2 points. A. The confederacy of enemies attacks God's people. This is one principle. And second, God intervenes on behalf of his people. This is like, core of everything we have in these 2 chapters. This pattern of God's prophecy can be seen fulfilled in principle in the life of Jesus Christ, who is the personified Israel or representative of Israel. The armies of Gog and Magog were united to crush him. Herod and Pilate, although enemies, were united in a confederacy in order to put Jesus to death. That conspiracy includes the Gentiles and the people of Israel, and thus Jesus Christ went through a universal plot against his person. Acts 4:27 attests the situation in large. Indeed, Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel in this city to conspire against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. This is really, in principle, fulfillment of what we have in Ezekiel 38:39. However, God intervened on behalf of Christ and raised him up from the dead. This is the second principle. His enemies were defeated and Christ became the victor. The Gog's prophecy is also in principle fulfilled in many analogical situations during the church history. What happened to Jesus Christ is experienced by his people, because what occurred in his life will be tasted by those who faithfully follow him. As he was persecuted, so will be his people. But as he was finally rescued, so will be God's children. Moreover, in the light of the New Testament teaching, the church is a Christian Israel. It means that a faithful remnant of historical Israel is enlarged by believing and Gentiles who together with Israel form one body, the church. The church consists of Jews and Gentiles alike, who believe in Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior and have entered into a covenant relationship with the Lord. Consequently, any attack on the Church of God, His covenant people, is an attack against God Himself, because Jesus intimately identifies with His followers who share Abraham's faith. The spirit of rebellion against God's people can be seen in situations of crisis throughout history. It is sufficient to illustrate the point with a few examples. 1. Nero's persecution of the early church. 2. The dominant medieval church fighting against the Waldenses, Hussites, and the Reformation. 3. Communists' attempts to crush religion and God's followers in many countries. In all of these crucial moments of history, the survival and the victory of God's people was unexpected. The conspiracy failed because the faithful followers of God who responded in obedience to him and his law. During those many perilous situations, one can ultimately recognize God's protective hand on behalf of his people. Thus, there are multiple pre-fulfillments of Ezekiel 38:39 during the church history. When the situation is analogical in principle, one can discern preliminary fulfillment of the prophecy about Gog and Magog. These fulfillments are only partial and typological. In other words, the multiple fulfillments in principle are an anticipation of the complete or full fulfillment of the prophecy in the eschatological time, when God intervenes in fullness to definitely defeat and annihilate all God's enemies under the leadership of Satan. This observation leads us to the eschatological, apocalyptic, final or complete fulfillment described in the book of Revelation in 2 phases. One phase, first phase, is connected with the second coming of Christ, and the second phase also is associated with the end of the millennium. And we need to ask how the prophecy of Ezekiel is interpreted in Revelation, and where the connections and allusions are mentioned to Gog's prophecy in this apocalyptic book. Therefore, the pre-millennial fulfillment, the event described in Ezekiel 38:19-22 finds its echo in Revelation 6:8-21, when terms like hailstones, fiery wrath, plague, mountains are directly used. Significantly, the new term Babylon is employed in this passage for the first time for Gog and Magog, Revelation 16:19. The great hailstones mentioned in Ezekiel 38:22 are also referred in the seventh plague, when hail weighing about a talent will add to the destruction already wrought in Revelation 16:21. The fire may find its counterpart in the lightning of Revelation 16:18. The Battle of Armageddon described the same situation of the opposition of the wicked to the people of God who behave like Gog and Magog in Ezekiel's prophecy. Therefore, Revelation 16 and Ezekiel 38:39 are in connection. Revelation 16:12 speaks about the great river Euphrates, and that its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. The Euphrates was a river in Babylon which flowed from the north. According to Revelation 17:15, water means nations. In the book of Ezekiel, on the other side, these nations from the north are Gog's allies, and the drying up of the water is the occasion of Gog losing his support. They fight against one another according to Ezekiel 38:21. And a similar description is provided about the inner fights of the followers of the beast in Revelation 17:16. This is a picture of the division and a foreshadowing of Gog's ultimate judgment of destruction and annihilation. In Revelation 19, the prophecy of Ezekiel 38:39 is applied to the events closely related to the second coming of Christ. In Revelation 19:17-18, the imagery and phraseology of Ezekiel 39:17-20 about the animal banquet are implemented. The battle is applied to the conflict between the followers of Jesus Christ and their enemies, the beast, the false prophet, and the kings of the earth, which are new names for Gog and Magog. Okay? Before was Babylon. Now are new names again. Beast, the false prophet, the kings of the north. The birds are invited to the great supper of God. In Ezekiel 39, birds eat the defeated forces of Gog and his allies. In Revelation 19, birds prey on the beast and the false prophet, who are then thrown into the fiery lake of burning sulfur, Revelation 19:20. In Revelation 19:19, this verse describes the conspiracy of the beast, the kings of the earth, and their armies gathered together to make war against Christ and his army. And Revelation 19:20-21 depicts God's intervention and judgment. These new names for Gog and Magog lead into the whole corpus of prophecy about the beast and the false prophet and their interconnection, especially in Revelation 13, where the plot to put God's people to death is pictured. Revelation 49 describes the opposing power of the three angels' messages as the beast and the image of the beast. And Revelation 17 represents God's judgment upon Babylon, because Gog here represent those who are engaged in a false system of worship. Thus, John clearly uses the imagery of the prophecy of Ezekiel 38:39, but exercises different terminology in order not to confuse its reader with the Antichrist power. However, in Revelation 20, and this leads me to the final point, the post-millennial fulfillment, In Revelation 20, verse 8 to 10, there is a description of a final, complete, and definitive fulfillment of Ezekiel's prophecy on Gog and his antagonistic forces. The names of Gog and Magog are finally directly employed as a summary description of all the foes of God and his faithful people of all generations of humankind. The consummation depicts the last judgment of God when Satan, the archenemy of God, and all his allies are destroyed, because the devil was the leader of all opposition and stood behind all rebellions against God and his people in all its forms from the very beginning. Gog and Magog in Revelation 20 is no longer only a confederacy of one country or a group or several nations, but a symbol for all nations and people of all generations who oppose God. It is a description of a universal picture of God's enemy. Conclusion. The definition of Gog and Magog becomes clear. Gog and Magog are not historical names, but a cipher or a code for opposing powers against God, his people, and his law. They are symbolic names for the antagonistic forces of evil. It is a disguise of the Antichrist in a large sense, an archenemy of God and his faithful followers. It is evident that John is deliberately interpreting Ezekiel's prophecy. He uses the phrase Gog and Magog at the culmination point of his book as the cryptic description of all the wicked, unbelieving people of all generations from Adam to the second coming of Christ, who stubbornly rebel against Gog and his values. Gog's prophecy is rooted in earlier prophecies in the Old Testament and goes throughout the major themes in Revelation. It is one evil power in principle, but manifested historically on many occasions in various characters, figures, and symbols. Antiochus Epiphanes IV is only a type of a farther and larger fulfillment in history in an antitype. From the time of Jesus, who tasted the full attack of Gog and Magog forces in principle as the representative of Israel, this anti-godly power was growing in intensity and also in magnitude. Throughout history, by analogy of situation, one can discern the Antichrist power at work, from Nero's persecution through different attacks on the faithful followers of God by the Inquisition to the atheistic and communist persecution, Christian and Islamic extremism, and religious terrorism. It expands more and more until it ripens, so that this ever-growing power is seen all over the world at the end of the world history. There are institutions, nations, communities, denominations, societies, regimes, atheism, capitalism, materialism, spiritualism, and other kind of ism, which may stand in opposition against God and his people. And in this case, it is a situation where the principles of Gog's prophecy apply. This application in principle does not preclude a particular apocalyptic fulfillment at the end of time. On the contrary, it leads to it. Thus, Gog and Magog is a Babylon who opposes God's people. It is the Antichrist in principle, whose activities and spirit appear throughout history, but will be finally defeated during the final consummation of time. And this description I made is depicted, I hope, in figure number 1. The names Gog and Magog are not names of an individual or a single nation, but symbols under which God's hostile forces are masking. It seems that the prophecy of Ezekiel 38:39 was meant to be primarily typological in nature, Gog being a type of the enemy of God and his faithful. Symbols were here are ingrained in history, because symbols point to a historical reality of a higher level. With the passage of time, Gog becomes a symbol for the whole rebellious world. This is done in progression and involves a long-growing development. Thus, our hermeneutical principle is of fulfillment, multiple fulfillment in principle by way of type and antitype. It is a complex typological structure, as it is seen in figure number 2. You have this movement there. This figure means enlargement and growing of the Antichrist power. The names Gog and Magog are not names of the individual, as I told you, and figure 2 depicts the enlargement and growth of the Antichrist power, which was manifested in the opposition of Antiochus Epiphanes, who was with its historical prefulfillment of Ezekiel a type for an antitype, the little horn of Daniel 7:8, the beast of Revelation 13 in Babylon. The apostasy and enmity grows and culminates in the whole last generation at the second coming of Christ, and finally climax after the millennium with the rebellion of all the wicked generations of all ages against God and his followers securely living in the New Jerusalem. Thus, in the light of Revelation 20, Gog and Magog, in the time of the last judgment, are a symbol of all generations of the wicked, describing the unsaved of all times. Ezekiel prophecy, with its fulfillment described in the book of Revelation, fits perfectly within the context of the great controversy between Christ and Satan. There is one war with many battles. This one universal war is represented by many symbols, and one of them is Gog and Magog. All these different symbols form together an eloquent mosaic of the holistic picture. Those who totally unite with Christ, the victor of the ultimate war, will be also victorious. God's love, truth, and justice will finally triumph, and also everyone who is transformed by God's love. Ezekiel 38:39 is a message of hope. It is the gospel about God. It is a good news about God's victory and the victory of his people with him. Thus, the main tone of Ezekiel's prophecy is comforting. It reveals clearly how strong are the principalities and powers of evil, yet it reveals also how much greater our God is. This prophecy demonstrates God's wonderful love and care for his people, as well as his sovereignty, victory, greatness, and power.